You're listening to KGVM 95.9 FM radio or KGVM.org. This is the Health and Happiness Program of Gallatin Valley. We have interesting guests often and topics which everybody would find very interesting. We have been sponsored by the Montana Psychological Association Public Education Committee for almost 8 years. We do all things health and happiness, and today is no exception. I'm Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, with Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. She will now introduce the program.
About 20 miles north of Helena, Montana, there's a sign pointing to Gates of the Mountain. Well, you really, truly need to take this side trip, but you wouldn't be the first. First were the Native Americans who left us messages carved in the stone cliffs. The next group that we know of was a procession of 13 canoes headed up by, you guessed it, Lewis and Clark, along with Sacagawea. Their description of the journey from Lewis's journals reads, "On Friday, July 19th, 1805. Well, the mosquitoes are very troublesome to us as usual, and this morning we set out early and proceeded on very well, though the water appears to increase in velocity as we advance. In the afternoon, we passed a very high part of the mountain and steep up from the river on each side, about 600 feet from the surface of the water, which we named the Gates of the Rocky Mountains. In the evening, we entered the most remarkable cliffs that we've seen yet. These cliffs rise from the water's edge on either side, perpendicularly to the height of 1,200 feet. Every object here wears a dark and gloomy aspect. The towering and projecting rocks in many places seem ready to tumble on us, and the river appears to have forced its way through this immense body of solid rock." Now, speaking from today, you can make that same journey in bright sunlight on a marvelous tour boat with every comfort and a scintillating guide to answer every question. We're so fortunate today to have Steve Tubbs with us to share his vast knowledge of this wondrous trek. We're also pleased to have writer and filmmaker Elizabeth Wood from New York City join us, because she was able to make this trek earlier this summer. Welcome, Steve.
Well, thank you for having me. That was a great intro that you just did. It was perfect.
Well, we wish everybody could have this really incredible experience. And again, we said if you are just north of Helena, about 20 miles, just make that little turn to Gates of the Mountains and drive down 2 or 3 miles to this beautiful lagoon, and there you start the journey.
Yeah, it's definitely a great trip. I've been doing it my whole life, but I still enjoy every time I go down the river. It's pretty fantastic. I'm glad you guys had a good ride, too.
Oh, yes. Tell us, Steve, how long have you been doing this particular event?
Well, you know, actually, this is my first year that I drove the tour bus down through the Gates of the Mountains. I actually grew up there. My dad ran the marina and ran the tour boats in the 70s into the 80s. And he was a boat club member before that. So I was born in 1957. My dad had a boat then, so I probably hit that river about 1959, first time I went down. I don't remember if that's when I started going down that day. So, it's been quite a while.
Well, we noticed that the boats have been running in that canyon for a long time. After Lewis and Clark, how long have there been tourboats available?
Well, it started in 1886.
130 years, ago. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's
The ranch there that you come through just before you get to the gates of the mountains, that's Nicholas Hilger. And he bought that ranch in the 1880s. And eventually, that's how the boat tour started there.
It's just such deep, marvelous history. I know Lewis and Clark were looking for a pathway over to the Pacific, and if anyone has been over to the Pacific, there's a large statue of Sacagawea looking out over the ocean. So they finalized their trip and they made their journey, but this is a very remarkable point in that journey, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is. It's just interesting. Out of the middle of nowhere, you have this beautiful limestone canyon down there that you can go through it. Mary Lewis actually went up through the canyon, and William Clark was over on the west side of those mountains. And there was four of them. They were looking for horses, or one of the tribes, maybe the Shoshone. But that canyon is pretty amazing. The pilot is always reminds me of someone telling me stories as you go.
Okay, well, could you stay close to your mic, please, dear?
Oh, yeah. Is that better?
That's great. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, there's so much more than just the history of that expedition, all about that canyon and that boat ride. Of course, that is pivotal to the trip to see where they came through, where they camped. But for anyone who's the least bit interested in birds, which should include almost everyone, we were just thrilled to see osprey nests and eagle nests. And did I understand there are about, 150 kinds of birds when you go through that canyon?
Yeah, there are a lot of birds. I don't keep a list myself, but one of the drivers down there, Tim Crawford, who's actually in two more years, will have 50 years on that river, used to manage it. He keeps a life list. He's definitely just a touch over 150, I believe, is how many he has on his life list. So there's a lot of birds. They're really interesting because you have the water birds and you have the mountain birds. It's quite a mix.
Peregrine, falcons, just...
Yep.
So, for those who have an interest in birds specifically, this is also just a wonderful trip to see where they nest and where they're the happiest. Yeah.
Yes. Mm. And we actually have the local bird community come down. Well, they come down at least two or three times a year down to the gates, and they don't go down the river, but they do come in, and there's so many birds down there, they enjoy that trip.
We're going to pause for a minute, Steve.
Okay.
We're having a little bit of in and out for your voice.
Let me do this.
Maybe he's here. Are you on speakerphone? Are you on speakerphone, Steve?
No, but is this better?
Yeah,
that's a lot better.
Okay, I'm not going to use this then.
Yeah, that sounds a lot better.
Yeah. Okay, let's just do this.
Great, awesome.
Okay.
And we'll get our engineer just to edit this part we're talking now.
Yeah.
Okay. I just got a new phone, so.
Yeah.
We understand.
This sounds great. This sounds great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, so when one takes that turn and goes down to the gates of the mountains, we're following history, we're seeing an enriched, unbelievable bird estate, and We also have a lot of history going in other ways there. And one nice thing about the tour is that we talk about so many different aspects of that canyon.
Right.
Yeah. So...
Yeah, it's... Oh, go ahead.
No, go right ahead.
I was just going to say, one of the interesting things about the area is how everything came together. I mean, they've run the trips for all those years, but we have the Hildreth Ranch down there that's running that, and we have the Gates of the Mountains Wilderness that's in there. But a big point of it is the Hildreth Ranch, before the Hildreths passed away, they put their ranch, which runs down the west side of the canyon, into that conservation easement, the agriculture conservation easement that saves that particular property from development. So those two things come together, plus the Gates of the Mountains Foundation that owns the property. So if you add all of that stuff up, there was a lot of things that had to come together to actually make this thing continue and work like it does now.
It's just beautiful, in addition to being historical. And I think anybody just being on the boat in the fresh sunshine, or even on a rainy day, I think would be great pleasure. But then you have all these added things. And I would like you to maybe talk about some of the animals that you have come across on your journeys back and forth, Steve.
Well, we have the regular animals. We have the mule deer. Now, the mule deer is what you would see down the canyon. The white tail don't actually come into that area. We have mountain lions that we've seen. Some of the turboats have actually had some amazing stories with the mountain lions. But we have the mountain sheep, the bighorn sheep that are in the area. And we have the black bears also. And, of course, all the little animals that live out there, the raccoons. And we have otters and beaver, muskrats. The list goes on. Also, we have the bats. According to the Fish and Game, that area down the canyon has the biggest population of bats in Montana.
That's incredible. And do I remember that you have a bat tour in the evening?
Yeah, well, we have bat tours. There's only five a year. The Fish and Game, actually, they're the ones that started it. And they come down with us on the bat tour. But they do it on their own time, so we can only do so many of them. But it is an amazing trip if you go down on one of the bat tours. They're kind of hard to get a ticket for, but it is actually an amazing. In fact, the Fish and Game is the one that did it. They're the ones to thank for that. They do an amazing job on that trip. They actually go with us, and they carry equipment on board that can read the signals coming from the bats, and they can tell you exactly what species that is, a bat that they just heard. So it's pretty fun.
Very, very.
How many species of bats do you have in the canyon?
Well, there's 14 species in Montana, and 9 of them reside in the canyon there.
Wow.
So, they have not been affected by the white nose disease at this time, so we're hoping that'll... But, so that the one thing that I did learn that I thought was really interesting on that trip with the biologist, bat biologist from the Fish and Game, was that in this particular area, we always think about bats living in caves. And they do live in some of the caves, but they say they prefer to go into the cracks of these rocks in the bark of the trees that burned in the fire in 2007. And they, so they're hoping that because they're not all together all the time, that maybe that white nose disease won't transfer as fast in that area. At least we're hoping.
That's so interesting. I always think of bats deep into caves, but they like other habitat as well. I think, too, it could be that little valley is so protected. No one can get there except by boat, except that one little camping area at one end. So the bats are very safe to be in a tree or in a crack, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, and the terrain not only is protected, it's also pretty... extreme terrain.
Yeah.
And I hike up there quite a bit and stuff, but it's not, most people wouldn't probably like hiking in there because of the cliffs and the rocks and stuff, as far as just taking off into the wilderness there. There are trails, but most of the time nobody's going to go up there farther. And that's definitely a good thing.
And when we were there, I was so impressed to see the eagle and the eagle's nest. Can you tell us about the eagle population?
Yeah. We don't have a perfect handle on what the eagle population is, but I think I'll just remind everybody that, you know, back in the 60s, we had the DDT problem, the pesticide that we used. And, of course, that pesticide would get into the water, and the fish would get it. The birds would eat the fish, and it caused their eggshells to break. They became very thin. The eggs landed on it, and the eggshells break. So the population of eagles and osprey across the United States had fallen quite low when they finally figured out it was DDT, and they banned it. But now we have eagles not only down the canyon. I think there's probably at least four nests in the canyon with eagles. And the ospreys come back. They've also extended all the way out to all parts of Montana, out in the, everywhere now. So they've really come back. But the population at the gates is amazing.
So, that's so good to hear. And I would say, even if there were no Lewis and Clark and none of the other historical information, just seeing an eagle's nest is very good.
And I remember telling us something. I'm sorry. This is part of what you were going to elaborate on. Eagles. I remember you talking about how many babies they had, and I can't remember your answer, but it was very surprising. Can you tell us some about that?
Yeah. So we have one particular eagle that we've been watching, and especially the gentleman Tim Crawford had mentioned. He's been there all the time, and he's a bird guy, so he's been paying attention to this eagle. And she's gone through some trials and tribulations, you might say. She had her mate die at one time, and we took it into the fishing game and make sure there was no diseases or anything, but she probably died of lead poisoning. But we were worried whether she was going to remate, because they mate for life. Well, she did, and this year she had two eagles, and that puts her right at 60 eagles.
Wow.
That she's raised. Now, I talked to Tim about it, and we figured out she's about 25 years old now. But we've been able to watch her through the years and keep track of her. So she did used to have four eagles when she was younger. But it's kind of an amazing. It's fun to watch something that long, for sure.
Have you given her a name, Steve?
You know what? Everybody asks that, but no, we really haven't. we probably should. Maybe you could have people send you some messages on what we should name her.
So, in thinking of this tour, there's so much to think about. Just being on the boat is very nice. It's a large boat. There are restroom capabilities, you know, every luxury, and being able to sit outside or inside in the covered areas. If people make that turn and go down to Gates of the Mountains, do you recommend, I know that we did, people make a reservation by calling, and therefore you'd be assured of getting to be able to get on that boat rather than missing the boat, so to speak?
Yeah, it is a good idea. It's kind of funny how everything's you need reservations now. A lot of times we might have room where people can walk in, but sometimes they're full, especially on weekends. It'll be sold out days in advance. So it is a good idea. You can just get online and get everything done online and take care of it. So.
Or we'll give a phone number pretty soon if somebody wants to grab a pencil who's listening. I know that there are also dinner cruises during the summer, Steve.
Yeah, they have some dinner cruises where you can, it's on the website there, but you can sign up for the dinner cruise. So they'll have a catering company in town comes out and they have a nice dinner there right by the tour boats, and then they take a nice evening trip down the river and do the tour. A pretty relaxing situation there, and that's pretty fun too.
Mm-hmm.
And we have done weddings and all kinds of things down there, so and people do charter the boat. That's another thing. If you have a group of people, you can call in and get a boat chartered for, and a different time of the day or something.
Mm-hmm. And if you have a school group, you would need to call and schedule that, I would guess.
Yes, and we do a lot of school groups. In fact, I'll be working Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and those are the last tours of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And then we start up the next 2 weeks with the we run school trips down, and then we're done.
And then you open back up in May, is that correct?
Right, yeah. Memorial Day is our first tours.
Mm-hmm.
And we do run some school trips before that. So.
Mm-hmm. We want to just note there are other whole aspects like Precambrian rock and all sorts of geologic formations.
Mm-hmm.
From the Proterozoic Belt Supergroup, Grayson Shale, just many very important rock stories for rock enthusiasts.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's a rock hound area. No, it's that Grayson rock is amazing because of how old it is.
Yeah,
it rated at 1,300,000,000 years old. So, but the limestone, I mean, it is so full of, it's almost full of energy back there. It's, you know, not only can you find fossils and stuff, but the shapes in it, the layers, and you can see the pressure and the heat that had to be there when those were turned and changed. It was pretty awesome.
And that's one of the things you pointed out so nicely on the tour. Look up here and you'll see one of the faults in the limestone.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of my friends who went on your tour is a, correct me if I say this word wrong, paleoecologist from Montana State, who said that going on your tour is one of the most interesting things she has done in Montana. And she found this information so interesting and useful to her studies. Do you have a lot of scientists come on your boat tour?
You know, sometimes they don't tell us, but we do. I have geologists come on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I would rather have them not tell me they're geologists until they're done with it.
Yep.
But, no, you learn a lot from these people. In fact, the last geologist on there says, I didn't hear a word you said. I was just looking at those rocks.
Would you be able to kind of take us on a tour right now? You've done it so often. Like, here we are at the dock, and we're heading out. You gave such a articulate, great description of everything. Is that possible?
Yeah, I could. I wonder, do you want to talk about rocks or just kind of a quick trip to the canyon?
Yeah, just a quick trip to the canyon. Here we are at the, it's kind of a lake, looks like a lake. And
yeah, it's, yeah, I can do that. We start out on what's called Upper Holter Lake. That lake is actually formed by Holter Dam. Now, Holter Dam would be downriver towards the north, towards Great Falls, Montana. About 25 miles up from the marina. That dam, actually, that water actually stops backing up there in Upper Holter Lake where we're at. If you were to go 5 miles up the river, you would run into Hauser Dam. And then 65 miles up from there, you would actually run into the headwaters of the Missouri, the Madison, the Jefferson, and the Gallatin, which form the Missouri, the longest river in the United States. And then as we take off here, you'll notice that on our right side is that Grayson Foundation, the rock that's actually dated at 1,300,000,000 years old.
Mm.
And then as we continue into the canyon, we'll talk about the different properties, but the main property is really that Hilger Ranch. Now, interesting about the Hilger Ranch is my dad was involved in getting them to hook up with the conservational easement. And so that's a pretty important part about the Gates is that. And then as we look ahead of us, we would see the beginning of the Gates of the Mountains Wilderness Area. That's a 30,000-acre wilderness area. It's pretty small for Montana. And then we have some houses and stuff on the American Bar Tour. Would be off to our right side. That mountain in front of us, the Gates of the Mountains, that's where you'll notice the first part of the burn of the 2007 Merriweather Fire. Merriweather is the camp or picnic area down at the end of the river. That particular part right there in front of us that we could see is interesting because that's a back burn. We don't fight fires. That fire started at Merriweather Gulch down there by a lightning strike in the wilderness. We don't fight fires in the wilderness, but this is a small wilderness area, so they did work on it quite a bit, especially on the perimeter of it. And the fire that we'd be looking at ahead of us is called a back burn. They waited for the wind to be blown up the hill and back into the canyon, and they actually lit that on fire. And that back burn burns back into the forest, meets the main fire, and that way, if everything switches, the wind starts blowing the other way, that fire will have a hard time moving back through the fire that was already there that was burned. So that would be a back burn. And it actually worked really well. All those houses mm-hmm. are still there. Mm-hmm. So. And then another interesting thing as we go into the canyon is the first thing we look at is the, well, we should talk about the limestone first, though. These cliffs that we're going into are limestone. They're dated around 300 to 325 million years old. And they were formed by a shallow sea. And that sea, they assumed, was around about 45 million years. So everything in that sea that was a plant life or animal life, when it died, it sank to the bottom of the sea, formed kind of a gooey, slimy mess, and eventually that turns into limestone. Now, the nice thing about that limestone is because of that, you have a lot of fossils in it that you can find down the river. Now, you can imagine that plain out there, that shallow sea with layers of that limestone stacked up over 45 million years old. And so you look it up at the mountains and you wonder, how did it get up there? Well, that's when the two plates, the Pacific plate and the Atlantic plate, started pushing on each other, called it mountain building. They built the Rockies with that, and it also pushed that limestone up. That's called the Madison Limestone Range. They pushed it up, but it didn't just push it up. It's that heat and pressure. So as it came up into the air, it was able to mold that rock. The limestone is a softer rock, it's porous, and it was able to make some really interesting geological formations inside of the canyon.
Can I just mention here, Steve, that as a passenger, you're on this beautiful blue, bright blue lake,
yes.
And then you come closer and it is towering. You are cranking your neck up to see the top of this canyon where you enter a narrow chasm, and it is just breathtaking. So keep going. I just wanted to give my perspective on it's awesome.
It is. It is actually. Every time I go down there and make this one turn with that boat, I feel the same way every time I look at it. Just that explanation. Mm-hmm. Perfect. But the first thing we come up to is a cave. Now it's in the rocks. Not very far from the boat. Now, the cave was dug in back in the 60s, somebody when they're looking for artifacts. But what they found was they found the animal bones, the teepee, or not the teepee rings, but the fire rings. And they also found some arrowheads and a scraper down there. So you can see it really well at the side of the boat. You look in there and you can see it's not very big, it's not very deep. It doesn't go back very far, but it's deep inside, so you could get in there late. So those people would have been teepee dwellers. They wouldn't have been living in caves or cave dwellers. So they figured that's something that they probably would have used as they traveled through the canyon. Through there, they would have used it as shelter.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the cave there. And, of course, at that point, we're going to talk about the bats. Kind of an interesting story. The bat biologist, this is probably about 15 years ago, he was in another cave in Montana. I'm not sure where it was, but somebody said, hey, have you seen the bats in the Gates of the Mountains? And so he came down and set up a monitor outside right in the front of the canyon, and they monitored the area for 3 years. Now, that monitor reads what kind of bats they are and how many. And they did find out at that point, that's when they found out how many bats were there, that there was more bats there than any place in Montana. And that's when they came up with the idea to do the bat tours. So it's been pretty great deal. We talk about a bat cave that's over there. It's just the whole area. There's it's never been drilled in or mined in, so everything is still the same. And in fact, if you take the cliffs that are like Arivalu said on each side of the river would actually be the same width in those areas, and we'd be deeper as we go down the river. But it would look a lot like it did when the expedition went through. In fact, he called it dark and dreary. Isn't that what he said?
But it was late in the day and cloudy and rainy. So
right.
When we went through, it was bright and sunny.
Yes, it's white. It's interesting. In fact, the rain kind of puts a little damper on the tour. But I'll tell you what happens with that canyon when it rains, it turns gray.
Oh.
Very dreary. If it rains enough, it's very porous rock, so that rock, that water will actually come out of the cracks and crevices. It's out of the water, it'll start dribbling out of there. But it completely changes. It's absolutely gorgeous down there in a rainstorm because it has different layers of gray that show up. It is dark and dreary, but it's one of the prettiest times to go down the canyon.
Wow, that would almost be worth another trip on a rainy day.
Yes, yes it would. We can give you a whole different tour, but no, that's really fun about that trip, because you can see different things every time you go.
Mm-hmm.
But as we go on, we talk about the Hunter's Point that comes out there, where the hunters were hired when the gold rush was going through Helena, or not just Helena, but the Helena area. They had a lot of people, but no meat, so they would hire hunters in that particular place. When the water was down and it was just the river, the animals used to migrate through that area, and they could get that Hunter's Point is on the west side of the river. They would be able to get in there with a wagon, and they could hunt for the animals and then take the meat to the different mining camps in the Helena area. And then the fun one is on the other side of the river is Fields Gulch, which is named after the two Fields brothers. They were the hunters of the group. And so when I was young, I lived out there. Everybody would always say that Meriwether Lewis camped at Meriwether Picnic Area, which is at the end of the canyon. And Stephen Ambrose, who wrote Undaunted Courage, a Lewis and Clark book, he came out there and did some, you know, he spent a lot of time. Actually, he's a World War II historian, but he read the journals when he was younger, and he just became fascinated with Lewis and Clark trip. And started reading, gathering information for his book. But he went down through there, and he said there's no way that they camped at Meriwether Picnic Area. He said that Meriwether Lewis surveyed from St. Louis to Oregon, and it was only off two or three miles on his whole trip. And for him to be at Meriwether Picnic Area, he would have had to have been a mile off just in that area. So he said that next area that we'd be looking at would be where they probably camped.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be something for the historians to find. That was his idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's right. It couldn't have been Meriwether Picnic Area. So that area right in there is interesting just because of the we know that the Lewis and Clark expedition did stay there. So, and as we go down, we look at a very large natural bridge. Some people call it the Arch. It's actually called Arch Gulch, and it's about 50 feet high and 50 feet wide. And since I was lucky enough to grow up out there, I've been on top of it, and it's interesting because the top of that arch is as wide as a sidewalk. You can walk right across it if you don't mind heights.
And if you've got good balance, yes.
Yes.
Very good balance, yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to fall. Mm-hmm. You know, but you don't think about that until later. So that's and of course we do, you know, the one place we end up just a little bit farther down on the river on the be the right side is Coulter Campground, named after John Coulter, who was in the expedition. In fact, if anybody's listening, that's somebody you should look up if you're interested in mountain men, read some of the John Coulter stories. But that's a Forest Service campground. It has potable water, and it has picnic tables, and fire pits, and bathrooms and bear boxes. However, you do need a boat to get there. You can walk in, but it's about 18 miles through the wilderness area. And that's a place that I've actually been in. And if you just go a little bit behind the campground, there's a little trail back there. I found fossils back there. There's a big lamp. You know, we took our three granddaughters. And we actually, the eight-year-old found a rock with like six ferns in it and a little shell.
Wow. So people who might want to camp in a site that's very special, very exquisite, very private, would need to hire a boat to take them into the campground or have their own boat there on the lake?
Have their own boat.
Talk about how people manage that.
Well, a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of boats out anymore, but also people with just canoes or kayaks will go down there.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need a big expensive boat to get down there. Now, on weekends, especially like the Labor Day weekend area, 4th of July, that becomes really busy. You know, might be a good time to stay out of there. But other than that, weekdays, a lot of times there's hardly anybody there. But yeah, you can come in with a kayak. The marina, Gates of the Mountains Marina, we charge for parking, basically, to launch a boat. That's an easy way to get down there. In fact, kayaking in the area is very nice. You have to watch out for the wind. But other than that, it's a beautiful trip down through there.
My goodness. Yeah. Do I remember that there's a cliff that a person was leaping from as we rode by?
Yeah. we call it Cheap Thrills. It's just past that Fields Gulch in between there and Coulter. It sits out over the water, kind of hangs out over the water. It's about 20 feet high, and it's 35 feet deep at that point. The water gets deeper as we go down the river. But yeah, next time if you'd like, we could jump off that.
I watched a lady jump.
Yeah, that was the weirdest jump I've ever seen, I think. The lady that jumped off there, she just marched off. She didn't jump. She just took off and went 20 feet back and never stopped walking. But she did it. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Okay, so now we're about halfway through the gulch. How would
you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, usually, like I say, we talk about the animals at that point. We've kind of gone over those different animals that we have. Now, we haven't seen grizzly bear down there or wolves or wolverines. But the wolves are not far. They're on the west side over not very far from the canyon. And the fishing game has spotted a grizzly bear up Merriweather picnic area about 5 miles up a year ago. So they're pretty close, too. Mm-hmm. I don't think either one of those animals like people, so they could have been there. You just don't ever see them.
Yeah.
So, and the bears, the black bears, we don't see very often either. We do, if you have like our garbage bins that we not protected with an electric fence, but they would come into that area. But other than that, you don't hardly see them. Mm-hmm. Then we end up going, we're going to go to the Merriweather picnic area. That actually, before there's the fire started there, we talked about it, so it was 2007, they called it the Merriweather Fire. It did start in the wilderness above Merriweather Picnic Area by lightning. So it actually didn't burn the picnic area out. Now, that picnic area before the fire was the busiest day picnic area in the Helena National Forest. We used to bring two boats down there, like our wooden boat, and we could unload people and they could picnic. And so they were very busy. The fire didn't burn the area, but what it did is it burnt everything behind it. There's a mountain back there that's 7,600 feet high, and their water's about 3,200 feet. But anyway, all the vegetation was gone. So when spring came and the snow melted, that whole canyon with no vegetation to hold the water back was a wall-to-wall river, and it filled, covered up all of the area with rocks and gravel, and filled up the building back there with gravel, so it was pretty much a mess. It was closed for a few years after that. And they did get in there and clean some of the gravel out to get the gravel out of the building, and then they sent in a group from the Montana Conservation Corps, a group of young ladies. I'm thinking they were probably around somewhere close to 20. They went in there and lived in tents for 2.5 months back there. Their job was to clean that area up, and they brought some red bark in and stuff, and they absolutely turned that place around and made it. It's just beautiful back there now. They fixed the building, painted it, and it was quite the job that they did. So that's another place you can get to by boat. It is there's no overnight camping, but it's a great place to have a picnic down there. So, and then we talk a little bit about the Hilger that started the trips down there, Nicholas Hilger. He came to Montana in 1873. He, I think it was 1873, 75, somewhere in the early 1870s. So he looked at mining, didn't like that, so that's when he bought the ranch there. And so what was happening at the same time was they were running steam-powered paddle wheel boats from St. Louis to Fort Benton, Montana, which is just about 100 miles up the river. And they couldn't go any further. They were bringing cargo in Montana, but they couldn't go any further because of the Great Falls that are there on the Missouri. So Nicholas, he thinks about that. He says, I could get one of those boats and I could drive it from Townsend, Montana, which is pretty close to the headwaters, all the way up to Great Falls and haul cargo back and forth. So he buys a boat in the 1880s. It was $2,900. And they got it in on rail to Townsend, Montana. They put it in the water. And he went down the river to Great Falls. It took him 12 hours. So, you know, he was excited. Everything's going to be good. He turned it around the next day and headed back up. And it took him 14 days to get back. Almost lost the boat three times. So that's when he decided that he needed to do something to make money with the boat. And he started the Tours of the Gates, 1886.
So when they say Great Falls, was it really a Great Falls there?
Yeah, you go up above Great Falls. There's a big falls up there. It's pretty. That's an interesting trip too. If you haven't been to Fort Benton or the falls there, those are both beautiful places to visit.
May I ask you on the tour? I was very interested by the Native American cave drawings. Could you describe some of those for us? And also, you had told us what the paint was made out of, and that was very intriguing.
Yeah. Well, in fact, after you go past Meriwether, just down the river a little bit from the canyon, there is a kind of a shallow cave up on the wall. And there is Native American pictographs in there. They're just off the canyon, but they're far enough up that it's still there. It hasn't been bothered, and it's a great representation of that Native art. But so the paint is made of iron oxide, egg yolks, juice from berries, blood, urine. And the whole thing about that is it has a lot of protein in it. And I'm not sure who got them here, but Texas A&M came in. And they went up there because it has protein in it. They can carbon date it. That's why we know it's in the paint. But they could carbon date. They actually did find a chip of a rock with some paint on it that was on the ground. They took it back to Texas, and they dated that paint to be somewhere between 1,500 years old or to 1,200 years old.
Wow.
So that kind of puts it in a whole different light. Yeah, we were thinking like 400 years old. But those people wouldn't have had horses. And somewhere in that era is when they were changing from spears to bow and arrows. You can see what looks like a buffalo up there. I never get this word right, but there's a zumbi, I think is what they call it, but it's a half animal, half man, and they've said that that would have been a religious kind of signal. But we don't know what it says. We have had the theory that's probably the strongest is that there would have been a religious leader in the group, a woman or a man, that they would go out and do like a shaman. They would go do vision quests, and maybe that's a place that they would have done a vision quest in. That's how the pictures got there. But the rest of everything is, I can make up some great stories, but
you don't even need to. There's so many wonderful stories totally there for us.
Like I said, you know, when you see that, it's as you go down, it's like the canyon's talking to you. It's just telling you stories all the way down.
It's just so multifaceted. There's just a story every direction that you look. There's one very sad story about another fire that happened. Steve, are we getting close to that one down the river?
That's where we're at. How do you know that's where we were at?
I remember.
So, yeah, we're talking about Man Gulch Fire, August 5th, 1949. It's just outside of the canyon, on the right side of the canyon if you're going upriver. So in 1949, there was a fire up there. So the night before, there was a big thunderstorm came through the Helena National Forest and started about twelve fires. And that was one of them. And it did 13 firefighters perished up there. Did you want to hear the whole story on that?
Yes, please.
Okay. So how it works is when there's a big fire like that, the forest ranger for the Helena National Forest would go out and they get in an airplane and they go look for fires that started. Now they leave at 7 o'clock in the morning, and this particular fire, they did not spot the Meriwether fire. They go out at noon again, and that's when they spotted it. Now, it wasn't a very big fire. It was about 20 or 30 acres up there. But the forest ranger knew it'd be hard to get anybody in that could actually walk up there, firefighter. So he called Missoula, Montana, and ordered 2 jump planes. There was only one available. It was a C-47. You might recognize it as a DC-3. So they fly over the area. There was a gentleman on board that they load up 16 firefighters and head for the canyon. But there's a gentleman on board. His name's Earl Cooley. He worked for the Forest Service for a long time. He was actually the second person to jump out of an airplane for the Forest Service when they were deciding whether or not it was safe enough to jump. They were doing it in the military, but they had to try it. So he's going to be a spotter for him. He's going to help him look at that fire. When we get up over the fire, he's joined by Wag Dodge. Wag Dodge is the foreman of that fire. They're looking out the window or out the door of the C-47, and they can see the fire down there. It's not very big, only 30 acres. And they say that they probably can have that out by tomorrow afternoon. So they proceed to jump in to the fire. Now, one of those smoke jumpers didn't jump. He was, this was his first year. He trained to be a smoke jumper. This is his second trip. Both trips, he became very ill and wasn't able to jump. So he actually flew back to Missoula and then drove home to Idaho after he got back, never to fight fire again. But as they jump in, everything turns out good. No accidents on landing. The only thing that happened was the radio. It was destroyed because the parachute didn't open up, but they didn't really care. They're firefighters. They got their tools. So Wag Dodge tells me, he says, gather up the tools, have something to eat. It could be a long night. And he heads up to the fire on the ridge. It's way up off the water. It's way up there. But as he's walking over there, he notices a man up on top fighting that fire. His name's James Harrison. He was actually the guard, the Forest Service guard, at the picnic area, where we had the picnic area. And he'd heard about that fire, so he'd gone up there to look at it. Now, he had been a forest smoke jumper the year before, and he loved to smoke jump. He liked to fight fire with his friends, but his mother didn't. And finally talked him into getting a better job. So he would, it's a pretty good job. You get to hang out in the in a cabin all year long and take care of the picnic area. So he sees that fire. He goes up there. He looks at it. And that's a 1,500-foot climb to the top of that ridge. There's a trail up there. He comes back down to his cabin, tries to get a hold of Helena on the radio to give him some information. He can't do it. He just puts a sign on the door and his cabin says, gone to fight fire. And he goes back up. Well, that's when he runs into Wag Dodge, the foreman. Well, Wag Dodge recognizes him because he fought fire with him the year before. So he says, well, just go ahead and join us. We'll go back, gather up the men, and figure out how we're going to attack this fire. But as Wag Dodge is leaving the area, that fire, now this is late in the afternoon, that fire starts blowing up on him a little bit. It's getting bigger. Now, these guys are used to fighting fires on the west side of the Continental Divide, the Gates of the Mountains. It's just over on the east side of the Continental Divide. And he's used to these fires laying down at night as it's getting later. It's later in the afternoon, and he's used to them going down, but this one's popping up on him. He recognizes he's in a dangerous area. So he tells his men, we're going to hike down to the river. We're going to go down and put the Missouri River behind you so we have a safety zone. And that's what they start doing, heading down. Well, that safety zone, that's right where we have the boat parked, sitting there talking about it, was actually, as that fire sat up there all day not doing anything, it was dropping embers into all that shrubbery down at the bottom. Not burning, not smoking. They didn't see anything when they flew over. But it's now late in the afternoon. And one thing that happens on an afternoon like that out there, the west wind will come up sometimes. Well, that, especially in late afternoon, that particular day it did. What happens is that wind comes over the Continental Divide. It comes down, and it gains speed. So you can have a beautiful day, nothing's happening. 15 minutes later, the wind's out of the west at 20 to 25 miles an hour, which pushes it straight up that canyon where all those embers are. And that area at the bottom of the lake they're heading for starts on fire. They can't see it, just like you can't see the top of that ridge from the lake. And they're still walking. Wag Dutch does climb up on a an area that he can see down there. He sees the smoke. He knows that that's blocked now, his exit. So he turns his men around and he heads them back up diagonally across that ridge. And that is very steep country up there, hard to walk in. He starts them up there. Not long after that, he looks back behind him. That fire's already crested the ridge behind him. It's moving fast, faster than they can move. A lot of grass up there. So then he orders his men to drop their tools and run. Well, they're not firefighters now. They're men running for their lives. Two of them, a 17-year-old and a 21-year-old, went straight up the ridge. There's some cliffs up there, and they make it to the top. They survive. The 17-year-old actually lied to get in before service. But they're okay. And then Wag Dutch, at the same time, comes up with this idea. They don't know where he got it from, or if he heard about it, or if he just made it up right then. But he yells at his men. He's got an idea. He's yelling at them. He says, come with me. Follow me. With those poor men, they didn't have much faith in Wag Dutch now. So they just cursed at him and took off running up the ridge. Wag Dutch kneels down in the tall grass in front of him. Wind's blowing up the hill. He lights that fire in front of him, and that grass in front of him, and up the hill the fire goes. He puts a wet handkerchief on his face, puts his hood on, buttons his coat, and he lays down into the, well, the fire's already 30 feet up the ridge, or 30 yards. He lays down into the black. He said when the fire went over him, he picked him up off the ground three times, 2 feet high. 10 minutes later, he stands up, he's fine. Not a scratch, not a burn. He's looking for his men, and he finally spots someone up there. He goes up there. This guy's severely burned, complaining about his feet hurting. And at this point, Wag Dutch, just mentally, he's out of the game. He helps him sit down, and he said, I sat there for an undetermined amount of time, which isn't something Wag Dutch would normally do. Finally, the two men on top see him down there, and they yell at him. And he does walk up to the top. There's another gentleman up there that's severely burned. It's getting late, getting starting to be dark, so they decide to see if they could get out of there. They go down the other side of the ridge. They call it Rescue Gulch now. And they got to the lake. It was dark. There actually was a boat sitting out there. It was probably a fisherman watching the fire. They gave him a ride to Meriwether picnic area, and the Forest Service was there with the fire camp by then. They told him this, what happened, and the next day the 17-year-old took the Forest Service up Rescue Gulch, and they did get those two men out of there, but they didn't survive through the day. So if you were to walk up there to the 2 miles up off the lake, get to the ridge where the fire was, you would find 13 monuments, one with each name of the firefighter they found at that point up the hill. And it's a pretty amazing place to be. The interesting thing about it is, it's a tragic story, but it changed the way they fought fires forever. They knew something happened. They weren't quite sure what it was, so they started two schools, one at Boise, Idaho, one in Missoula, Montana, and they started learning about fires. We get a lot of firefighters down at Gates, and if you were to talk to one of them, they'd tell you that one of the first things they learn is that backfire, that safety fire that Wag Dutch built. So, and in case anybody's interested, there's a really good book. It's called Young Men in Fire. It's written by Norman McLean. If you're interested in that story, that would be a good book to read. So,
Thank
there's
you.
There's your story.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, there's...
It is a sad story.
Yeah.
I actually had a gal on there just bawling on the phone.
Yeah.
I felt bad. But it's an interesting story because of what happened. You know, they did learn some from it. And the forester did a job of preserving it and putting the monuments up and stuff like that. So
I'm so happy to think there is a monument to their efforts. And
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you walk up there, it's hard to get to, but you need to get a boat ride down there usually. But it's not a hard walk. It's about 2 miles straight back. But when you go up towards the crosses, you... you're going straight up, basically.
Yeah. Well, we cannot thank you enough for sharing so much of the richness, and I'm sure there are aspects we haven't even touched on yet.
Yes.
We would like
to...
You
got me going.
Yeah. Oh, we'd like to say that the touch points would be to get on your computer and go to gatesofthemountains.com. And you could get more information, and you could make reservations. There's also a phone number, 406-458-5241. And we found everyone there to be very helpful and friendly. And if you do drive down, for some reason there's a sign on the highway that says, no food or drink down this way. But we found that they did have lots of food and lots of drink. Kind of, in the last couple of minutes here, describe the little resort area for us, please.
Okay. Well, it actually is a marina, the Gates of the Mountains. We have boat docks out there. There's boat club members. And we have the main tourist center there. So we have, you know, they do have food. That's where you get your tickets from. They have a little restaurant there, and they have a lot of t-shirts and hats they sell there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually pretty fun. That's where I get all my clothes. So. And they do have the books too. They have Young Men in Fire, they have Undaunted Courage that Stephen Ambrose wrote. They have one that my sister-in-law wrote called Sacagawea Needs a Day Off.
Wow, incredible.
Yeah, so she's actually got a master's degree in history, so, and her father was actually Stephen Ambrose, so that helps out quite a bit.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, wow.
This is really just steeped in the history and the people who've been there, who are keeping that history alive, and we really appreciate your family, your father, Steve, who helped take care of that whole area, and those that gave up their land and their properties so that history could be preserved and that we can all go and enjoy this. And
yeah, it's a beautiful place.
We'd like to thank you very much for coming on the Health and Happiness Show. We encourage those in Gallatin Valley who listens to KGVM to go and take this tour. You can't beat it, and you can't beat the director and the person that we've had today on the program describing its historical events about Lewis and Clark, Sacagawea and that group. And may I say, when they finally got to the Pacific Ocean, where the statue is, it's right south of Astoria, I believe, Oregon. You ought to look at that as well. Thank you again, and we want to hear from you again about this program and the history of it. And our listeners, please tune back in. You can listen to this program at 7 o'clock on Monday evenings or 10 o'clock on Thursday mornings. Thank you again.